On behalf of Rajib Mitrat. And I think you know from my briefs that my sort of global position in this case is that he's doing 96 months in prison for a crime he did not commit. And I think you know from my briefs that I believe that to be the case because I do not think that there was sufficient evidence to convince a reasonable jury that he damaged a protected computer. But on my way down here, riding in that train on the tracks, thoughts of critical infrastructure crossed my mind as from time to time the tracks seemed a little rickety, and I thought that led me into what I think may be the most easily dealt with but most complicated issue here, and that is our Booker issue. Whatever I wrote in my supplemental brief now, I've been trying to keep up with all the various circuits' decisions and some of even the district court decisions throughout this country on Booker. Whatever I wrote and filed on the 8th is probably outdated, so I would like to take just a moment and tell you what I think, as of today, is the appropriate way to dispose of Mr. Mitra's Booker claim. And by the way, I think it's important to know three things, and I know you know this from the case. This was after a trial where virtually every issue was contested, and we do have in this case, in my view, both the constitutional error that Justice Stevens, in his opinion, wrote about, but we also have the statutory error that Justice Breyer wrote about in his separate 5-4 opinion. Now, in terms of the constitutional error, in this case, I think it's a substantial constitutional error because we have before the jury the issue of damaging a protected computer. We know what the jury thought of that. But then we have Judge Shabazz making the leap to substantial disruption of a critical infrastructure. I don't know that it necessarily rises completely to the idea of apples and oranges, but it's a large leap to make, and it was done by preponderance of the evidence, by judicial fact-finding.
But, of course, your problem is that after Booker, these decisions are still done by the judge on the preponderance of the evidence.
Yes, right? But not mandatory, and that's where we come
right.
to.
So the only change, so far as you're concerned, by Booker is not who decides and not under what standard, but whether there is additional discretion that the judge didn't perceive he had. Now, one of the things that is true about this case is the judge gave a sentence higher than the bottom of the range. Doesn't that suggest that the judge did not view himself as constrained by the guidelines? I mean, one way to tell whether the judge is constrained is that he gives a bottom of the range sentence, which implies that if he thought he had more leeway, he would have given one, might have given one lower still. But when the judge gives a middle range sentence, he's implying lack of constraint.
I'm thoroughly convinced that given the opportunity, which is where I think it does belong, back in the district court, we ought to let Judge Shabazz decide that issue. I think what a middle range sentence means would be post-Booker means a middle range sentence.
Well, or perhaps, I guess the question is, if the judge perceived that he was working within a different range, would middle also have been different?
In this case, yes. I think so. In other words, middle might have been, instead of 96 months, maybe it's 44 and a half months.
Well,
that's what middle means.
No, we got two different questions. One is, did the judge calculate the guideline range correctly? And then the second question is, that's unaffected by Booker. The Booker question is, did the judge perceive how much discretion he had? Or did the judge erroneously
yes.
view more constraint than there was?
Well, as you know,
the calculation of ranges is utterly unaffected by Booker.
Well, except that what may be different is whether having come up with a guideline range, whether that's the last word, or whether the judge says, well, here's the guideline range, but for 3553A reasons, I actually think, you know, well, some defendants may wind up with higher sentences than the guidelines. I mean, I think this may, in some instances, be a situation of be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
You may get it. And so I question, actually, in some sense, whether every defendant really is going to want the Booker discretion.
This is not that be careful what you wish for case. This is your worst case scenario type case. I have guys who rob banks and major pharmacists, drug dealers running around the city of Milwaukee who are getting less than 96 months. What Rajiv Mitra did was broadcast porn sounds over police radio.
But he also disrupted the police emergency system. You know, if it had been a moment, I think, as far as I can tell from this record, thank heaven it wasn't, you know, but if some person had needed ambulance service and died as a result of the fact that the police couldn't communicate with each other, that would have been pretty awful.
Can't we sentence him, though, for what he did and not for what might have happened?
Well, what he did is he put that scenario at risk.
What he did is he prevented the system from being used for communication. Whether somebody died as a result of that was out of his control.
Well, what he did was, it depends on which date we're talking about, but
third conviction, which also greatly affected his sentence.
Well, maybe, you see, this comes back to the point, and that is, are we sentencing him here today, or are we going to remand to Judge Shabazz to let him exercise the discretion that he didn't really think he had much of in the first place? And that's where I think this case needs to go, is back to Judge Shabazz, because, again, it involves both constitutional error and involves also the statutory error.
When you say statutory error, are you really just saying that you think Judge Shabazz made mistakes in his applications of the guidelines?
Well, no, I'm sorry. What I meant
what
by that was that it's
about
a Booker statutory error, but I did, we have, in this case, quite clearly, challenge those guideline findings
right,
and sort of the old system basis as well, that no, he did not cause a substantial disruption of a critical infrastructure, et cetera. I mean, that's all part of the brief. But I thought it was necessary. I mean, that part of the analysis is sort of old school. The new part is, what do we do now?
I hate to say this, but what you refer to as the old school is the future as well. And that Justice Breyer's opinion made it clear that the guidelines remain, that the main focus of these appeals is whether the guidelines were properly applied or now reasonably applied. And that's where attention really ought to be.
Well, that's why I think I brought the challenge in both. But when I said old school, yes, it may be the future, but I mean it's the analysis of whether or not that guideline was appropriately invoked. That hasn't changed since January 12th. That's old precedent analysis, but now we're here in a new day to figure out whether or not it really, and I think it's important to keep in mind, again, that the error here in terms of the constitutional error is a major one. These are not facts that, you know, it doesn't make any difference whether or not it was found by the jury or by the judge, if the judge is entitled to find these facts. This is a total, you know, a tectonic plate shift in direction that Judge Shabazz took this case because he thought he had mandatory guidelines that he had to apply. And by the way,
Perhaps the difference is, I mean, we have one example from the past that may be an interesting one for us to consult, and that's from Chapter 7 of the guidelines, when people are sentenced on revocation of supervised release, where the guidelines have all along been advisory for the judge. And some judges, the judges are supposed to consult the guidelines, yes, but they very frequently say, I don't think this is enough of a sentence. I'm giving, you know, up to whatever, you know, 24 months, 36 months, whatever it may be in that instance. And that model might be the model that the court envisioned for now the guidelines as a whole, not just Chapter 7.
Again, I don't think that Booker is a deal with the devil. I think that Booker is what it is. It requires that judges exercise discretion and say so and give reasons why when they do. If they want to adopt as advisory and then put into practice the guidelines. If we go back to Judge Shabazz...
Well, they have to adopt as advisory the guidelines, and surely it wouldn't be an abuse of discretion for a judge to say, you know, I see this book of sentencing guidelines, but I've thrown my copy in the wastebasket. I'm just going to sentence from now on between, you know, whatever statutory minimum may exist and the statutory maximum. The judge is going to need to convince us that the guidelines were taken into account.
Yes, but this,
which I think is why Judge Easterbrook is saying that they're not out the window, they're just in the window in a somewhat different room.
But this case should not be a bottleneck that prevents that ordinary exercise of judicial discretion at the district court level.
Look, let me come back to the core of my question.
Yes.
You have so far not even mentioned the standard of review that is applicable here. It's the plain error standard because no Apprendi objection was made in the district court. Olano says there are four distinct inquiries to establish plain error. You might want to try to show us that all four are satisfied.
Well, it's in my supplemental brief, but that brings me to the point that I did want to get to, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity. I think the plain error review in some ways is fundamentally unfair. This court...
Look, and the Supreme Court told us to apply the plain error doctrine. We're going to.
Well, nonetheless, you might recall that this court sort of shut down that argument. Booker didn't make that argument.
The prosecutor did not argue plain error in Booker.
I understand, but...
The prosecutor has argued plain error in this case.
Yes, now that he's had the advantage of looking at the government's petition for writ of cert in the Booker case, and the Supreme Court did not deal with it as if it was dealt with in this court, even though it was mentioned in the Booker opinion.
The U.S. Attorney didn't want to argue plain error in Booker itself, because post-Blakely, the government was very interested in getting, let's say, the merits of the issue, the question whether Blakely had indeed... done what we've now found out it did to the sentencing guidelines. But anyway, I mean, I do think the last paragraph of Justice Breyer's opinion says we expect reviewing courts to apply plain error. And the question gets down, I'm going to focus you even more on the third and fourth elements, which are those that
you
the
should
US
be aware,
attorney,
counsel, by the way, that you're probably in your last minute.
I was waiting for
the lighting system is not working properly.
You mean the last minute of my 15 or my 10?
I think you're in the last minute of your 15.
Oh.
If you would like to save that minute, I certainly would be happy to.
I need something
this.
For rebuttals, so...
Fine, save it.
I guess I'll sit down.
Okay. We'll see if we can get the lighting system fixed before we bring you up and perhaps give you a little more time to account for the unexpected surprise.
The white one doesn't want to.
There's a leaf.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Maybe we've got it back fixed. We'll give you a couple extra minutes to account for the surprise, Mr. Wasserman.
Good morning. Tim O'Shea for the United States.
Mr. O'Shea.
Unless there are issues...
Now, there's a switch in the right that you can raise the podium.
I'm not that tall of a guy.
All right.
Thank you. Unless there are questions about the sufficiency of the evidence in the jury instruction, I'll get right to the Booker issue, which seems to be the only genuinely viable sentencing issue here. The defendant did fail to raise the Sixth Amendment challenge, and we do review it under plain error, and we turn, of course, to the third and fourth prongs of the test. I respectfully submit that the defendant cannot show either the third or fourth prongs of the test, and I'll address them in turn. Under the third prong, we ask whether Mr. Mitra can show that the mandatory application of the guidelines substantially affected his rights.
But in that instance, I mean, on the third prong, it seems to me the best analogy we have is the post-Apprendi era. And most of the post-Apprendi cases where there was a reason to believe the sentence could have been at all longer, particularly post-Glover, but post-Apprendi, we said the third prong could be shown that this is the judge sentencing within the constraints of the guidelines as perceived as mandatory certainly did change things. And many judges weren't venting anymore about the guidelines on the record. They'd been told by this court, they'd been told by many courts to be quiet and follow the law. But in terms of affecting substantial rights, once you've gone through the whole exercise of the guidelines, it's almost certain that this has influenced. I mean, they were supposed to influence the judge's sentencing.
Right. I respectfully submit that under the plain error test, the substantial rights under Pree from this court and Dominguez Benitez of the Supreme Court, the question isn't whether it influenced it. The question is whether the result now would be different.
How do we know? What if under a post, you know, Booker world, instead of seeing, you know, a guideline range, you know, at offense level, whatever he was, I forget, he was criminal history too. What if the judge thought that something either higher or lower defined the range, and then people naturally think, well, I'll split the difference. They put it in the middle. I mean, there's so many possibilities.
Indeed. There are so many different possibilities. There are three boxes. This court will see three boxes of cases. One where the district court expressed that the sentence should have been higher. One where the big box where the court said nothing in the smaller box, and I'll argue that later on today in Bothan, is where the court actually said, I wish I could sentence you lower. So those are
right. And not very many judges were saying that
did.
Only because, and not necessarily because they weren't thinking it.
Right.
But because they had been told that it was not an appropriate kind of comment to make in a legally binding regime.
Absolutely. But in this case, Your Honor, in this case before us, for three reasons, this court can feel confident that the result would be the exact same. The first one is really the biggie, and then two lesser ones. Judge Shabazz in this case said, the district court in this case actually used his discretion and said, hey, look, I believe that there is a basis for an upper departure in this case. And that was in light of the fact that the defendant attacked the radio system 36 times, you know, over an 11-month period. He said, hey, look, I think there is a basis for an upper departure. But the court went on to say that he believed that the guidelines provided him sufficient latitude to sentence the defendant correctly. So that's the big, you clearly have the district court exercising his discretion. Okay, what are the other two? Well, as Judge Easterbrook points out, the court elected not to sentence the defendant lower in the range. He could have sentenced him 9 months lower.
But my problem is how much can you read into that? Now, the first point that you make might be close to something where you could say, suppose, you know, the judge had asked himself the hypothetical, you know, out of the entire range of sentences within the constraints Congress has given me, where would I put it? Well, perhaps Judge Shabazz was telling us where he would put it. I'm not sure that, though, the range itself, middle of the range, bottom of the range, top of the range, when the range might have been different, is terribly probative.
You know what? From my perspective, this is where the burden comes into play. Because the Supreme Court has said, hey, look, the burden is on the defendant to show that the result would have been different. So if it's a toss of a coin under the Supreme Court's decisions, the defendant must lose.
But you know what? The problem with that logic that I'm having is that it takes us too far, because the government has argued already in this court that there will never be plain error if the district court chooses a sentence that would otherwise have been proper under the guidelines. And that, to me, is too much, because it means that the last paragraph of Justice Breyer's opinion is just as meaningless in that direction as it would be if you just said every single sentence goes back. You know, so we're looking for the middle ground, and I don't see the stopping point, because short of being able to be a mind reader, no defendant is ever really going to know what the district judge would do.
Right. The plain error standard, in all standards of review, are the court's tools.
Let me ask you, if we had reviewed this case, you know, on February 1st, 2004, instead of close to February 1st, 2005, and we had decided that there were no guidelines errors, so we rejected all the sentencing claims that had been made, then we would have, of course, just affirmed the sentence. And you're telling me that Booker made no change in that. You're saying that if we review the guidelines and we find no error, then we should always affirm because there will never be plain error.
No.
And I'm concerned about that position. And if that's not your position, I want to know what you think would actually satisfy the plain error burden.
Well, I want to say that my analysis is constrained by the plain error burden.
Tell me when there will ever be plain error under your view, given, as you have said, that the burden is on the defendant, given that the defendant has to know whether a district judge might have exercised discretion differently, and that we have essentially no way of reading a person's mind.
I think oftentimes it's going to come down to the fourth prong.
Give me a concrete example of a case where you, in your honest opinion...
Sure. Let me pose to you the question how the United States would view a situation in which the district judge says, I believe that it would be a good idea to give a lower sentence in this case, but as I read the guideline manual and the decisions of the Seventh Circuit, I am constrained from doing that because of Application Note 3, which says that I should not, and therefore, although the defendant has asked for a lower sentence, that request is denied.
Right.
Judge says that. What happens on plain error review in the United States' view?
Well, I'm going to cut into my 10 minutes on Bothan, but because I'll be arguing that in a little bit, and that's exactly what happened in Bothan later on this morning. But then we get to the fourth prong, and then we decide, then we go through and say, well, you know, we have this court in the Messino dissent saying, hey, look, this is not a CJ.
Dissent. Being the operative word.
And in McReynolds, where this court also went on to say...
Different context, McReynolds.
2255, absolutely. But look, either way, we're...
But see, if this is a long way of saying to Judge Easterbrook, we don't think that should be sent back either, that's not plain error, then I come back to my question.
Right.
Is there a set other than the null set?
Right. And then we get to the situation.
Could you just... Tell me.
I'm trying. An example would be just that example where the judge says, I wish I could go lower, and the evidence is not overwhelming or uncontroverted. In that situation.
What do you mean by that?
It's not a question of evidence. It's a question of how the judge exercises his discretion.
In the court.
Are you saying something like the judge expresses a desire to go lower and...
Which
this
satisfies
court would
the
not
third?
Reverse on the United States' appeal if
no.
the judge did that?
No, I'm saying...
Because the if the judge...
Okay.
No, listen, just I'm listen before
to,
you
I apologize.
Talk.
I'm sorry.
If the judge expresses a desire to go lower, but by doing so would have imposed an unreasonable sentence, and in the post-Booker world, we would have reversed on the prosecutor's appeal, then not going lower couldn't possibly be plain error. But if the judge expresses a desire to go lower, and we would not, in the post-Booker world, have reversed on the prosecutor's appeal, then one might think that that was an example of plain error. Now, is that your position, or do you have a different position?
That is, I believe, stated the position a different way. The reason, if the court says, I think I would go lower, that takes care of the third prong. Then we turn to the fourth prong, and then the question is, we have the sort of systemic process-based questions. Is it okay? You know, it's been around for a long time, since 1987 and so on. Okay, you got that stuff off
the side. The Supreme Court has certainly not said, they could have said, because we are still leaving the guidelines in place as advisory, no sentences that were otherwise lawful under the guidelines should be upset, and this is really a purely prospective decision. They didn't say that.
They did not.
And so we are left with the thankless task of figuring out exactly what that set of cases for both the third and the fourth part of Olano are. And that's, I think, why some of the courts of appeals, the Second Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, one panel of the Sixth Circuit, I don't know what the Sixth Circuit is going to wind up doing, but some panels have basically said, look, the only really safe thing to do, even in a plain error context, is to get an indication from the district judge whether whether the result would be different. Ask the district judge, in a sense.
Right. That would be the expedient, easy thing to do. Easier for everybody in the judicial
process.
And
more stable, too, because what if the Supreme Court winds up agreeing with, you know, with the Second Circuit? Then everybody who goes your way is going to have to get resentenced again.
Well, the problem with that is I would respectfully submit that it takes expediency and it discards analytical rigor.
Well, how about expediency and fairness to the defendant? Does that factor into the government's position at all?
The Supreme Court told us to apply the construct of plain error. And if expediency blows off the third and fourth prongs. Look, these are the court's tools. These standards of review are your tools.
Well, but I think blows off the prongs is a lot to say. I mean, for courts of appeals all the time get indications from district judges as to how they would respond to things. We do that with certain 60B motions. We do that with all kinds of things.
Right. But we have to ask whether the result would have been different. We have to ask that. And we also have to ask.
But you see, what you're setting up a situation where you will never be able to say that. So you're essentially reading any review out, which I don't think the Supreme Court did.
The plain error test by the Supreme Court is a tough hurdle to beat. And I'm analyzing this case in that context. The Cotton case said, look, and even under the fourth prong, we look at whether or not there's overwhelming evidence. That's what the Supreme Court said. This isn't O'Shea making this stuff up. This is what the Supreme Court and this court have said. And if there's overwhelming evidence on a point, as there was with all three of the contested points in Mitra, then the defendant doesn't even prevail on the fourth prong. These are your court's tools. If we're not analytically rigorous with the third and fourth prongs, then it impairs this court's ability to use these tools in the future.
Let me ask you one more question about the Second Circuit's approach. If I understand the Second Circuit's approach, what it has done is ask the district court to say whether it makes a difference in order to get at the third of the four prongs. District court reports back, yes or no, or I don't know. And at that point, the Court of Appeals still will make the fourth inquiry. Now, on the United States' view, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is it turns the appellate process on its head. You get the district court involved in whether or not the third prong is met.
Yes, and can you explain to me what's wrong with that? We have to know whether there's prejudice. Most of the time, in the way the legal system works, the Court of Appeals can decide by itself whether there was prejudice. Here, where the prevailing change in legal doctrine is a change in the amount of discretion a district judge has, maybe only the district judge can determine whether there was prejudice. We still presumably have to apply standards 1, 2, and 4 of Olano by ourselves. Why not ask the person who knows?
Because it siphons out the burden.
Because
when
why?
You do that, it siphons
so
out
why?
The burden.
I mean,
out.
It would be like there were facts that were missing, and we send it back to the district judge to fill them in.
One can conceive of this as a fact about what the district judge would have done.
Right.
We find out that fact. The district court makes a finding of fact about what he would have done with more discretion. And with that finding of fact, comes back and we apply the Olano standard. Now, problems here?
Yes, it takes the burden. The burden is on the defendant. If the defendant cannot prove the fact at the appellate level, then the defendant loses. What we're saying is, hey, look, it's a toss of the coin. We don't know district court.
So your view is that if there's a plain error question, completely forget about Booker, that if the record is just devoid of evidence on some particular issue that would help us decide whether there was prejudice, for example, the attorney doesn't interview a witness the defendant would like to have interviewed, so we don't have in the record what that witness would have said. Your view is the defendant always loses, that the Court of Appeals would never remand to the district court to find out what the missing witness would have said.
Yes. Yeah. I appreciate the court's attention. I will look forward to speaking with you a little bit later on.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wasserman, we'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you. I did consider for just a moment not coming back up after all that, but I do want to address those issues that you raised before about substantial rights. Now, the government indicated in its brief that this was a novel case. It's still a novel case. It was filed back in November 2003. You still cannot find any other case that charges someone under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act under the same facts, not before and not since. That has something to do with substantial rights. The evidence is not overwhelming. It's not essentially uncontroverted. This is under Cotton. And again, it's a novel application of a criminal law by the government's own admission. Moreover, it was the government that discouraged the district court from departing upwardly. That's at 50, the record, the sentencing transcript.
Of course, that's your big worry. It would not surprise me if we were to send this back to the district court after Booker, to have the district court say, Booker does make a difference. My sentence is going up. Does your client know that that's a risk, by the way?
That's not a substantial risk, and that's what
I... Does your client know that that is a risk? Have you told your client that if you press this Booker issue, your sentence may go up?
He knows that, yes.
Okay, and he's willing to take the risk.
Now, if you want to know what I actually told him about that, I'll be happy to put that on the record as well.
No, I don't want to invade any attorney-client privilege here. I just want to make sure that he is making a decision rather than you making a decision for him. I think there is, and I join what Judge Wood has said, I think in the post-Booker world, the sentences for a lot of nonviolent and some violent crimes like bank robberies are going to go up, and the sentences for drug offenders are going to go down. And your client is in the set of clients who, my prediction is, are going to be worse off after Booker.
My client is unique. We're all unique in terms of DNA, but in terms of where he stands legally, again, he's unique. It was a novel prosecution then. It's novel now. He's a novel defendant. The government and the court acknowledge that he was an immature person with unusual skills.
Normally, we don't expect criminal defense lawyers to look at the world through rose-colored glasses.
You do or don't?
We do not.
Do not.
Nor should you.
Nonetheless, I think that all those factors show that his substantial rights were affected. All this, to use an overused term, geschwein about how he might be worse off, I didn't come here thinking he would be worse off. I didn't put that in my brief. He doesn't think he's going to be worse off. Judge Shabazz, I don't think, does either. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wasserman. The case is taken under advisement.